I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Because today is the day that we truly embark on a comprehensive agenda of economic, social, and racial justice in the United States of America. That's what this agenda is all about. Because climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life, not just as a nation, but as a world.
That was New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez earlier this winter announcing the Green New Deal alongside Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Their ambitious non-binding resolution calls for a 40 to 60% reduction in human sources of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and net zero emissions by 2050. To get there will require nothing less than the complete transformation of the country's economy and infrastructure. While many on the left have embraced the Green New Deal, critics have had a field day calling it impractical and the rollout amateurish. Earlier this month, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was dismissive, labeling it the Green Dream or whatever they call it. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he wants a vote on the resolution, hoping to put some Democrats on the spot. We asked Robinson Meyer to join us. He's been writing about the Green New Deal for Atlantic Magazine, where he's a staff writer who mostly reports on climate change. In fact, joins us from the studios of The Atlantic. And Rob Meyer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thank you for having me. I've been a listener of this show for a while.
I know, since you were a child, right?
Yes, exactly. I used to listen to the 11 p.m. rebroadcast.
There you go. Let me just give out the phone number and ways that our listeners can join our conversation. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Rob, you know, I was thinking about to the 2016 election, especially the presidential election, climate change barely registered as an issue. Here we are, 2019. People are talking about the Green New Deal, whether they like it or not. Do you see this resolution as helping or hurting the cause?
I think it's in terms of getting people to talk about climate change, I think it's definitely helping the cause. I think that we just have seen a level of discussion about climate policy and what is required to retool and change the U.S. economy to fight climate change, kind of no matter how that happens, no matter what policy eventually will make that happen. We're talking about that and taking it seriously in our political system in a way we really haven't in years. And I think kind of no matter what the immediate outcome of that, more discussion of what it's going to take is almost certainly a good thing.
Do you think all these weather crises we've had in the last couple of years, that has focused people more on this issue?
I do. I mean, it's tricky because on the one hand, the weather is
the
only,
weather, right?
It's the weather, right? It's only sometimes bad. So and we have had a lot of weather crises or, you know, disasters lately that seem really linked to climate change. Aside from hurricanes, like all the California wildfires that have been, you know, bad at a level they've never been bad before, to borrow, I guess, Trumpian syntax, like all the wildfires are very clearly linked to climate change and seem to bear, you know, the real kind of fingerprint of human activity. And when you look at polls, people say, oh, I'm taking climate change seriously now because of the weather. On the other hand, it's still the weather. And we could go a couple years now without seeing, you know, kind of one of these climate-addled disasters and discussion might fade.
Absolutely. Do you see this, though, when you look at the Green New Deal as an SOS? Essentially, the ship is going down and we have to do something now to fix it.
I mean, I think that's how the framers of the Green New Deal see it. And I think they're not entirely wrong to see it that way, I guess. We are at a extremely important moment for the planet's climate. And we have been at that moment for the past 20 years. And every second that we wait to adjust our economy, to change how we make things and move around the world and do all sorts of different important, you know, economic and social and activity, every moment that we wait to do that, it gets more and more expensive to fix climate change, and climate change gets worse and worse. So, you know, the sooner we move, the better. And we are getting to the point where the Earth is going to warm. I mean, the Earth has already warmed by 1 degree Celsius. We seem on track for, you know, at least 1.5 degrees, if not more. The longer we wait, the more technologically impossible it becomes to kind of avert that warming.
And that seems to mirror what a lot of people have been saying in the last couple of years, which is looking ahead the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, that these are critical decades where we have to do something.
Exactly. So the UN says we have to, in order to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which is, you know, a little, I think 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, and of course is much higher in our latitudes. So we'd experience that as, you know, between 6 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit warmer during the summer.
Right here in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, exactly. So in order to hit that, we have to half our greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and get to net zero by 2050. And that's going to be really hard.
Well, and going to the New Deal, the Green New Deal, and obviously there was a reason to call it the Green New Deal. It is short on specifics. I think we have to be honest about that, talking about efficiency and upgrading buildings and get, as you mentioned, 100% power from renewables, upgrading the infrastructure, sustainable farming, healthy food. And there's a long list of goals in this Green New Deal, but not much about how to get there.
Yeah, exactly. And I the way I would understand this document that Representative Ocasio-Cortez, you know, and Senator Markey published a week ago at this point is it is almost like a request for proposals. It is a list of goals. It's them saying, here's everything we think should eventually be in a Green New Deal. How we get there, we could use a lot of different ways to get there. You know, if we want to change, if eventually we want to switch the whole fleet to electric vehicles, like the whole fleet of private, you know, American-owned cars to electric vehicles, well, there's lots of different ways we could do that. We could subsidize the purchase. We could use tax credits. We could subsidize the production. But eventually we need to get to this goal, which is that everyone will be driving an electric car.
Hmm.
And so I'd understand, like, the list of that they published, it really is a list.
A list,
and it
yeah.
really is – it's pretty short exactly on specifics. It is more goals at this point than policy. And I think they have been clear about that, probably to their credit.
Well, and, you know, just to be boring here, I think we get something like 80% of our energy from fossil fuels as it stands now. I was reading a couple of different figures, but that seemed to be the one that I kept coming back to. So if the goal is to get us essentially off of fossil fuels, is there a place you think for nuclear? And I realize that's a very controversial possibility, but nonetheless, do you think in the Green New Deal that there are ways and people that support it, there are ways to support that idea, or is that just off the map?
I think so. It's nuclear is such a controversial issue. You're exactly yeah. right, and I think it's so generational too. So, I am 27. Having listened, given that I already gave away, I grew up listening to the show. And nuclear has never been a huge issue, you know, I think for people of my generation in the way that it was a huge issue for people who are a generation or two older. Mm-hmm. It has never been the big highlight environmental issue. The big highlight environmental issue has always been climate change. And for people a generation older, it's really like nuclear is the thing. And they got into environmental politics to fight nuclear power, and then they became passionate about climate change. If you look at the Green New Deal resolution, it uses very curious language, which is, I think, quote, like 100% clean, comma, renewable,
yeah.
comma,
right.
and carbon-free energy. Whether that's an inclusive or exclusive and, I think they've yet to decide. Generally, when you talk to people about it who are activists who have been involved in this, you know, people do come out kind of all along the spectrum. They say, absolutely, we can't retire existing nuclear plants early. The question is whether we build more of them and whether that will be feasible. I would say that when you look at energy models, it becomes a lot easier to change the energy system and the power grid if you can build nuclear.
Well, I'm a bit older than you as a baby boomer, and I certainly remember what life was like before a lot of the environmental legislation that we have now. When, you know, a Great Lake was on fire. I remember a summer in Philadelphia in 1970 where I don't think we saw the blue sky because the pollution had essentially sort of moved in over the city. So it's interesting that we kind of know where we've been, and the question is, how do we move forward?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's so interesting, too, because I think, you know, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act were so successful. They really did change both how industry worked in the U.S., how healthy the air is to breathe. They created very robust systems for, you know, helping public health while preserving the environment. They were also almost like single generation issues, and that's not a pejorative. It's like we kind of first realized in a public health way that, you know, car exhaust fumes and factory pollution were really, really damaging. And, you know, within a couple decades, we had gotten the Clean Air and Clean Water Act passed.
And it made a difference.
And it made a huge difference. But then things started to get better. Then the air kind of started to improve. Waters of the United States started to be cleaner. And climate change is this tricky issue, first because at this point it's been 30 years and we haven't done anything about it yet, or we haven't done much about it yet. Mm-hmm. And secondly, because it's just going to take a while to fix, even when we start fixing it. So the Earth will be warm by the end of the Earth will be warmer than it is now by the end of my life, barring some miraculous technological innovation, and we'll be dealing with a warmer Earth for generations to come.
In fact, you're right. There's a kind of a mismatch between all the, you know, the images of what climate change looks like, and then the boring kind of cold antiseptic policies that have to be decided on to address what looks so scary.
Yes, exactly. So I wrote recently about what I think of as like the boring as dirt problem,
right,
which is when Trump goes up there and he talks about repealing climate legislation and he stands with coal miners or he stands in front of, you know, gas burning cars and American flags and he looks kind of heroic repealing all this bad regulation. Then blue state governors or legislators want to be able to fight him somehow and want to be able to say like, oh, no, we are pushing back against climate change. But what a state can do and what the federal government can do are so different and so out of proportion with each other. And not to mention also that just like what a state can do is really, as you said, really technocratic and scientific and boring. And it's a lot of like, oh, we're going to adjust soil carbon levels. And you wind up with this boring as dirt problem where it's so boring to actually fight climate change, some of these policies.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Robinson Meyer is our guest. He's been writing about the Green New Deal for Atlantic Magazine, where he's a staff writer reporting mostly on climate change. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Atlantic Magazine's Robinson Meyer, Rob Meyer, about what's in the Green New Deal, whether the goals are feasible, and the politics that stand in the way. He's with us for the next 20 minutes, and you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Rob, let me just ask you, I do want to talk about the political future, I guess, for the Green New Deal, but at the same time, looking at the legislation, it has a kind of kitchen sink feel to it. And by that, I mean there are, tied to this idea of dealing with climate change, are questions about life expectancy and income inequality and the gender earning gap and the racial divide in the country and the economic stagnation, in a sense, trying to connect everything all together. Do you think that's a misfire, or do you think they have something here?
I think that it is. I think, you know, it's an interesting approach.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot in the, as you say, there's so much in the text that is not strictly about climate. There's
right.
the job guarantee is something I would pull out, which guarantees every American a job with paid medical and family leave.
Right.
likewise, there's a
and
promise
paid vacations
to,
as well.
And paid vacation, exactly. And likewise, there's a promise to honor every historic indigenous treaty, which is a big deal. I think these are, you know, they're laudable goals. When you talk to the people who wrote the Green New Deal, they feel like they're going to create such an economic boom with these policies to remake the economy and sell solar panels and wind turbines and everything else to the rest of the world that they want to make sure everyone can share in that wealth.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point those elements have been so overplayed, including by the authors, that it has this real kitchen sink quality, and it loses the focus of the Green New Deal as something that wants to remake the economy in almost a more industrial way, and kind of make it work better for everyone. So I think I don't know that they're all bad policies per se. I think at this point, AOC's tendency to sometimes play them up more than she plays up the climate policies mm-hmm. may not serve her very well.
Well, do you think that's why Mitch McConnell wants a vote on this, essentially to call out the Democrats and say, okay, let's see where you stand on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, you know, AOC's office, when they published the Green New Deal text, also published this FAQ.
Yeah.
Some kind of a background document.
Mistakes there, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it mentions all sorts of things that aren't in the text, including like we can't deal with all the farting cows at once, which is like, in fact, it's true that methane production from cattle.
It is true. Right.
Yeah, like is a big greenhouse gas problem, but maybe that's not how to talk about it. And maybe there's also ways to fix it without seeming like you're addressing all cattle farmers, right? It also addresses, it kind of comes out against nuclear. It comes out against capturing carbon from the air, which seems like something we should maybe learn how to do. And it has it talks about abolishing planes and replacing them with high-speed rail. I mean, it's all this stuff that it was really not in the text and is kind of, I think, pretty juvenile to see come out of like what is supposed to be a serious policy operation.
Right.
And I think that was then played up so much by Republicans, you know, successfully and, you know, stapled onto this argument about socialism and how AOC represents socialism that McConnell wants to get them on the record, you know, wanting to abolish planes, which isn't something that's in the Green New Deal at all, but is something that they can argue and attack ads and stuff.
Let me read a couple of comments. A question from Dana. She says, I support the Green New Deal in theory, but I'm wondering what are the practical steps that can be taken to feasibly implement some of these goals, which is what we've been talking about. And I guess just picking up on that, Rob, which is, I mean, taking this sort of broad-based deal, what is something practical that can be pulled out of this?
So I think there's a huge practical core to the Green New Deal. Even once you set aside all the racial and, you know, indigenous equity stuff that's important. And that is that the Green New Deal really reformats how Democrats talk about climate change because it is centrally industrial policy. It's centrally a way of saying the federal government should collaborate with private business and cajole them, not necessarily command them, but incentivize them and set up all these things that get private entrepreneurs to innovate toward these goals that we want. And there's lots of ways that could happen. There's lots of ways we've done that in the past. We could tie federal procurement, what kinds of cars or power the federal government buys to these climate goals. We could tie federal prize money or federal patent law to these climate goals in certain ways so that the federal government only gives you maybe a military contract if you're going to manufacture technology in a green way. That kind of kitchen sink approach is something that I think will be in any kind of future Democratic climate bill now.
Right.
And is something that will probably be emulated. And it's a big change from how Democrats have thought about climate change historically, where they've been more focused on maybe making it expensive to emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. You know, the core of the Green New Deal is making it cheaper and incentivizing people to produce clean energy and to do all these things we need to do to the economy to not emit carbon dioxide, basically.
But do you think it has a future only if Democrats essentially control the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives?
Yes.
I mean, we ran that experimentally briefly not so long ago.
Right, exactly. So, right, yeah. So I guess 10 years ago at this point, Democrats had a supermajority in the Senate.
Yep.
Then they had a slightly less than supermajority after Ted Kennedy died, but they still couldn't get a climate bill through the Senate. They also ran that experiment in the early 90s. The BTU tax from the Clinton administration would have functioned in many ways similar to a carbon tax and would have done a lot of early decarbonization work. And that also didn't get through the Senate. So, Democrats are going to need the Senate, and that's going to be really hard in 2020. They have to win, like, Georgia, Iowa, a number of historically red states. And then they'll probably won't have 60 votes, so they would either need to figure out things to do in reconciliation, which is the weird.
This is the boring part you were talking about, right?
Yes, this is the boring part. Yes, exactly. So they either need to figure out some way to write the bill where they can it all applies to the federal budget, and they can pass it with 51 Senate votes, or they can repeal the filibuster, which they can also do with 51 votes. You know, but all these things are contingent on them winning the Senate in 2020, which is going to be very hard.
Let me quote you something you wrote in The Atlantic, and you're talking about the Green New Deal, calling it positively Hamiltonian. That would be Alexander. And you write, like Representative Ocasio-Cortez, he wanted massive federal spending on new infrastructure. Like Donald Trump, he believed that very high tariffs can nurture American manufacturing. And like Elizabeth Warren, he was willing to bend the Constitution to reform the financial system. Of course, it takes us back a couple hundred years, but people love. I saw the Broadway play, but do you think in real life that Hamiltonian ideas have some resonance?
I mean, I think so. I should say that the best treatment of this issue is on theatlantic.com, and everyone should go read it because I'm worried about summarizing my own piece, but yes, I think absolutely. And I think this idea that the Green New Deal is about industrial policy is kind of centrally a Hamiltonian idea and not a socialistic one. And the reason to talk about Hamilton is that Alexander Hamilton is the first person who, as Treasury Secretary or just from a position of power within the federal government, remade the U.S. economy. He said, okay, right now we're a colonial economy, we export a lot of commodities, we aren't very industrial, we need to impose high tariffs, we need to invest in all this internal infrastructure so that we become an industrial power and can really compete with Europe. And reforming the financial system was right in line with that. And so when you talk to the authors of the Green New Deal, they cite this kind of new vein of scholarship that draws on Hamilton's ideas that says the federal government, you know, the idea that we let the market decide about what the U.S. economy should be is a very new one. And in fact, when you look at American history, the federal government is constantly going in and collaborating with entrepreneurs or investing in such a way as to open up whole new areas of economic expansion and growth in the U.S. economy. And, you know, classic example is the World War II mobilization. But another example is the early Republican Party in the 1860s and 1870s gave away a ton of federal land in the West and invested a ton of federal money in infrastructure improvements such that, you know, by the end of the Civil War, the North was producing way more cotton and all sorts of commodities than the entire country was at the beginning of the war. Like, that was the power of the infrastructure improvements they made. And those infrastructure improvements also involved giving away federal land to states so they could found land-grant colleges. It involved giving away federal land to railroad companies so they could build the Transcontinental Railroad. Intervention.
We've been here before, you're saying.
Exactly. Time and time again in U.S. history, the federal government has intervened in the economy in such a way as to make further growth possible. And that's when you talk to the authors of the Green New Deal, that's what they want to do again. And they want to do it so that we can kind of be the big climate change power.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Corey. Does the opposition to the Green New Deal represent a change in the mindset of Americans? Are we more pessimistic now than we were when Kennedy promised us the moon? That's an interesting philosophical question. Is it a pessimism? Is it politics? Is it just that we're kind of at each other's throats when it comes to policy?
I think it's tricky. I mean, it's funny to talk about the moonshot in this way, both because AOC compares the Green New Deal to the moonshot like this all the time. Also because when you look at public policy polling from the 60s, people didn't love it. Like, people didn't love the Apollo program. They thought it was a boondoggle. They kind of thought it was a bloated military program that we didn't need. And it's only in, no offense, in boomer memory, sure, as like children watching this, that we that the American story has become, oh, everyone loved this. We were all behind this. It was an amazing thing. It also, of course, helped that they actually got to the moon and there were lots of amazing photos and videos of it. I think there is definitely a, you know, there is a pessimism about what we can do. There's a sense of, is it worth fighting climate change given, or are we just, is it just going to happen? And there is a degree to which, like, everyone, the entire political spectrum is radicalizing because it seems like nothing can get through the federal system. So you might as well pick your pie-in-the-sky policy and then try to ram that through because nothing happens. Insofar as this argument that you see that, like, is it even worth fighting climate change? The answer is absolutely yes, because the more we prevent CO2 and other greenhouse gases from entering the atmosphere, the, like, more survivable and easy to handle climate change will be. So every little bit counts on that.
Here's an email from Michael. The goals and ambitions of the Green New Deal should make people uncomfortable because it will take total transformation of our economy away from carbon-based industries and energy sources. Democrats need to be leaders on this issue and vote in favor of it. An email from Brina. For my entire life, environmental interest groups have spent the majority of their resources trying to defend the environmental laws from conservative assault on the environment. The Green New Deal gets us focused on solutions. Even if aspirational, this is a good reorientation in the movement's focus. And a Facebook comment from Andy who says, what is the contribution of CO2 to climate change by gas and diesel motor vehicles? That's a very specific question there from Andy. Can you take that, Rob?
Yeah. I mean, I could say I could not tell you what gas and diesel generate specifically. What I do know is that transportation. So that's the whole transportation sector, and it involves airplanes and diesel locomotive trains, but also gas cars and diesel trucks and diesel buses is between 25% and 30% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions right now, and is in fact the leading cause of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions because coal has declined enough that now electricity generation does not generate the plurality of greenhouse gases. So it's about 25% to 30% is the whole transportation sector.
How about buildings and inefficiency? That's certainly part of the New Green Deal. Is that I know some people are doing it themselves, you know, individually on their own apartments or homes. But how important is that?
It's pretty important. So buildings are about 15%, I think. Mm-hmm. Basically, when you look at the whole U.S. greenhouse gas mix, it's like 55% is transportation and electricity together. Industry is another 25%. Buildings and farming are the rest. So, you know, it's really like building heating systems. It's a big deal. And it's a big deal because it's such a classic market failure in that, we would all like to pay $5 or $10 in a home or more, or possibly like hundreds of dollars less per month on our electricity bill or home heating bill. But that's not like the first thing you're going to buy with your tax refund. That's not the first place you're going to invest money. It's like a little minor kind of tax on your expenses, but it's nothing you notice. So people just never make those efficiency upgrades to their own buildings. And so it is important because if the federal government were to incentivize that more or even mandate it somehow, it would save people a lot of money.
I remember doing a number of shows about, I believe it was either Bush or the Obama administration, about getting more efficient light bulbs. And now I see an article saying that the Trump administration basically wants to undo that after people have put LED lights and tried to transform their own house, or even cities doing that as well. And it seems we get, one step forward and then a one step, or maybe more than one step back.
Yeah, exactly. I think the LED case is interesting because in some ways it's a lot like the Trump administration's war on coal, in that the Obama administration imposed a regulation. It said we all have to move to LEDs. Because of that, there was a ton of investment in making LEDs cheaper. They were already really cheap, and now they're cheaper. So it's what people are going to choose anyway. And so in some ways, it doesn't really matter what the Trump administration does to the law on the books, because it's the cheaper option now, and so people will choose it. And that's kind of what's happening with coal, too, where, like, no matter how they try to repeal regulations on coal pollution, natural gas and renewables and other technologies are so much cheaper now that coal will never really be able to come back.
So about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. So what is the future for the Green New Deal?
Well, I think we're going to hear a ton about it in the Democratic primary. I think candidates will jockey to position themselves on it one way or another. As for after that, it depends on what happens in Congress in 2020, in the Senate specifically. But I think the next time that a Democrat is in the White House and has a Democratic Congress to work with, we are going to see something called a Green New Deal. Whether it looks exactly like this, I don't know. But the next time that there's a stimulus to be passed or some kind of big work to be done, I think Democrats are going to try to get something like a Green New Deal through. And it may not be as ambitious as what Representative Ocasio-Cortez debuted. But I think it could do, potentially a lot of good.
Well, Robinson Meyer, thank you so much. Rob Meyer, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Hey, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was fun to be on.
There you go. From a listener to a guest.
Exactly.
That's Robinson Meyer, and he's been writing about the Green New Deal for Atlantic Magazine, and he's a staff writer at The Atlantic, reporting mostly on climate change. After this very short break, we'll be talking about some plans, they may not happen or not, having to do with seismic testing off the coast of the Atlantic Ocean. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Nine states along the eastern seaboard and a group of environmental organizations have sued the federal government over plans to conduct seismic testing in the Atlantic Ocean off the coastline, searching for places to drill for oil and gas. They say the use of air guns shot every few seconds violates the Marine Mammal Protection, Endangered Species, and National Environmental Policy Acts because of their harmful impact on marine life. Here's what an air gun sounds like, recorded by our guest, Christopher Clark. We asked Christopher Clark, to explain how this kind of noise travels through water, is picked up by whales and dolphins and plankton, also about our increasingly noisy oceans. He's a professor in the bioacoustics research program at Cornell University. And Christopher Clark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to join you this morning. Thank you.
You know, I'm going to play that again because I want to make sure our listeners hear it, and then I want you to tell us what it is that we are listening to and how this is picked up by marine life. Let's listen to it one more time. Now, did you record that under the water?
Absolutely, yes. This is an underwater recording, two explosions from an array or set of roughly 40 air guns, which is towed behind, that set is towed behind a ship, and every 9 to 10 or sometimes 11 seconds it explodes. You would also hear in there, you might have heard some very faint kind of little pings. Those are the sonar system on board the ship as well.
How many decibels is that?
Well, it's roughly about 260 decibels,
wow.
And this can get confusing for people. This is a term that's a relative term, and that when someone says, well, it's as loud as, you know, a rock concert, well, the decibels we refer to in air are different than they're referred to in water, so it can get very confusing. But let me just put it this way. Those explosions are so loud or so physically determined that they are actually creating a bubble in the water. It's like boiling water, and it creates a large bubble, and it's that explosion and implosion of that bubble that creates this massive amount of energy. It's basically a stick of dynamite going off every 10 seconds.
And if I'm a whale, how do I hear that?
Well, it's extremely loud. That is, it's energetically very intense. And so, for example, I've been recording the voices and the songs of whales all over the world's oceans for most of my life. And I can record off of the coast of Virginia in the exact same area where some of these companies want to run these surveys. I can record the voices of a singing blue whale off of Ireland, right? The voice of a singing blue whale off Ireland will transfer itself across the ocean and arrive on the east coast of the United States, you know, 35 to 40 minutes later. And the same reason why I can record that blue whale singing off of Ireland is the same reason why I can hear the explosions,
wow,
from a survey off of Ireland across the ocean. So I can hear surveys that are happening off of Brazil, off of West Africa, off of Ireland, off of Nova Scotia, off of Labrador. I can hear those same explosions on that same recorder. So the ocean is pretty much just transparent to the acoustic energy and noise from these explosions.
How does a whale react to that?
That's the big question. Sometimes we have are able to observe responses which indicate the whales are attending to the sound, but it's not so offensive that they do much about it. But those are the sounds, for example, that are coming thousands of miles away. In other cases, we have evidence that whales abandon entire feeding areas and areas that are critical to them for their survival. So they will abandon an area which is as loud as all of New England, for example, which might be a feeding area. And when those explosions are going off and they're persistent, these surveys are not for an afternoon. These surveys are for many, many weeks and months at a time. So they will see that kind of abandonment. This is the challenge of this problem of how do you assess the effect of all this noise and these, mm-hmm, offensive explosions on populations. And these animals live to be over 100 years old. So when someone asks me, well, does it affect the population? I'm going, well, I better check with my grandchildren because they're the ones that are going to be monitoring the population. They're very long-lived. We know very little about all of the details of their culture and the society, but we do know that they are completely dependent on producing sounds and listening to sounds in the ocean for almost all of the things they do: navigation, finding food, finding mates, detecting predators, finding where the currents are that they're going to rely on for feeding, all those kinds of entities of life that you and I use our eyes for. They are dependent on a quiet ocean and their own voices for maintaining their social networks.
And as you mentioned, these air guns, essentially these seismic sounds, can go on for months, but they also happen every, 5-10 seconds. So we're talking about just kind of a relentless sound that is then picked up by this marine life.
Correct. It's typically not as short as 5 seconds. It might be down to 9 seconds, but you're absolutely right. So in many cases, depending upon how the sound travels through the ocean, and you know, your listeners, we're all experienced with listening to echoes off buildings or distant thunder. If you're close to the thunder, it might sound like a massive explosion, but if you're 100 or 200 miles away in the ocean, it sounds like this big sort of big smudge of noise, and this is why I refer to it as acoustic pollution or acoustic smog. The other thing that's quite alarming now is that science is now documenting the effect of these kinds of explosions, not just on whales, but on fish and on the food that fish rely on to eat. So there's now good scientific evidence showing that it actually kills krill.
Wow.
And krill is a form of ocean life that is the food for so many, many animals, including the animals that we harvest in the ocean and rely on for food.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christopher Clark. He's a professor in the Bioacoustics Research Program at Cornell University. And we asked him to join us because there's a lawsuit, a group of environmental organizations, and actually 9 states along the eastern seaboard. They are suing the federal government over plans to conduct the seismic testing. And we played for you what that sounds like, seismic testing in the Atlantic Ocean off the coastline, searching for places to drill for oil and gas. As I mentioned, there is a lawsuit, so we're not sure exactly what's going to happen next. But we wanted to understand how these sounds affect marine life and how they travel through the ocean. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One of the things I read from NOAA was that they could alert vessels if there were protected species that would be swimming near a site. They could use acoustic monitoring to detect the effect of these sounds on marine mammals. Does that in any way give you any confidence that both things can be done at the same time?
No, it does not. The reason I say that so emphatically is that those attempts to monitor and possibly mitigate, alleviate the impacts on the animals, they're all very close. Those efforts would help reduce the acute impact of an explosion. It's sort of like saying, well, I'm with my buddies, I'm 12 years old or 15 years old, and I have a bunch of firecrackers, and I'm throwing them up in the air, and I'm trying to avoid having a firecracker go off near my ear so that it would physically deafen me. That's the kind of actions those procedures are designed to help. But you have to think of this in a very, very different way. These sounds are so prolific and so intrusive into the ocean scene is that think of yourself looking down on the Earth from a satellite and the kinds of maps we see every day for weather systems and whatnot, that you're now looking down on the surface of the ocean, and instead of seeing colors that indicate the temperature of the ocean or the wind on the ocean or the wave height on the ocean, you're actually now looking at the level of noise, how noisy it is in that part of the ocean. And when these explosions go off, they radiate noise out, and it's just like watching ripples on the pond, but the ripples on the pond in this case extend out to hundreds and hundreds of miles. So if you're in a boat, looking off the back of the boat with a pair of binoculars, trying to see if there are any whales in the area, it's almost ludicrous to say that you could do something about monitoring for the effects of this noise source, because the noise source fills the entire Gulf of Maine. It fills the western North Atlantic out to hundreds and hundreds of miles. And we don't yet understand the impact of those intrusions on the ecosystem. We don't know what happens with young fish. We don't know what happens to the food source. We know that there are indications that there's some real issues here that are really would lead me to say, well, we have to be much more careful about just sort of letting all these ships go out and set off a bomb every 10 seconds for 3 or 4 or 5 months.
Let me play one more recording you did, Christopher Clark. And this is right whales, and these are some greeting calls. And I should say to our listeners, there are a couple little pauses you're going to hear, but let's listen and then we'll talk about it.
Thank you.
so great. What are they saying, Christopher Clark?
Well, these are the voices of two whales that my wife and I had been observing and following for many hours when they were many miles apart, and they were calling back and forth. And this very simple, sort of almost like cow-like sound that they use is the way they contact each other a long distance. It's a long-distance call. It's sort of like, hello, I'm here. And then they came together, and when they came together, that's when you started hearing those sort of higher, kind of kinds of sounds. And this is the essence of their ability to maintain our social network, understand where there's food, and basically the calling each other and communicating with sound and listening to the ocean with sound is they're totally relying on that for pretty much everything they do. And these animals, when you watch them over these long ranges, because we can follow them acoustically, we're starting to learn that they have individual signatures in many of their calls, and there is a whale culture that we're starting to finally unfold. This is not as simple as somebody saying, well, hiya, hiya, hiya. This is much more complex than that, and they're totally reliant on their communication and listening to the ocean. We've followed animals navigating along the coast, and it's as though they had a map, an acoustic map of the entire coastline. They seem to know where Hatteras is, and they seem to know where the inlets are, the big bays. It's as though over time, because these animals will live to be, many, many decades, and some of them live to be 200 years old, that they're maintaining their consciousness about the ocean through their acoustic mind, not through their visual mind.
We have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. You have talked about the kind of the fact that the ocean is a noisy place, not just because of seismic testing, but I'm assuming ship traffic, for instance. You've talked about something called acoustical bleaching. Help us understand what that is.
Yeah, it's my attempt to try and translate what the scene would appear like if you were using your eyes. When one of these explosions goes off, it's very much like having someone set off a flash camera in front of you, where your eyes or your visual sense is shocked, and it obscures, it inhibits your ability to listen in this case, but if it's a visual scene, it inhibits your ability to maintain your sight until that your eyes recover. And in this case, of course, the flash is the explosion from the air guns, and that's happening every 10 seconds. And imagine that that's your life every 10 seconds for weeks and months at a time.
Hmm.
So that's the bleaching part. It's just obscuring your ability to pay attention to the sounds from your colleagues and your mates, as well as listening carefully to the ocean, because the ocean's noise sources, the waves and the storms, and the lightning bolts are all clues as to where you are and where you need to go.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times, Christopher Clark.
Well, thank you. I'm really very happy that you allowed me to give some explanation.
Absolutely. He's a professor in the Bioacoustics Research Program at Cornell University. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.